Blog Talk Radio.
This is a program for all America.
Steve, America's still here, right? Not completely functioning, but we're still here. Hey, welcome aboard. It is the Amy the Thorkby Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. Shutdown still in full swing. They're talking, but not really. We'll talk more about that a bit later. Some scary things happening in the Capitol beyond the gridlock yesterday with that deadly car crash. We'll talk more about that. But interestingly, the folks who handled it, the Capitol Police, they're not furloughed because they're essential, but they're not getting paid. Congress is. Yeah, more on that. And surprisingly, what's more popular than Congress? May surprise you, maybe not so much. We'll talk about that, too. First, though, the number in motion, if you're listening live, 9 a.m. out west, 11 a.m. central, and noon here in the east, 347-857-4505. You can also tweet your questions and comments at AB Writes. Aurora monitoring the Twitter feed for us once again. And we already have some tweets coming in for our guest fan fave. Dr. Daniela Schreier is back. It's been, a while since we talked to her, back in the summer, and it feels like summer here in the Northeast in October, but lots of stories to cover, the psychological angles of all the big justice stories that are on your mind, and we have some suggestions to get to in a few minutes. First, though, always a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Daniela. Hey there, Doctor. How are you?
I'm very well. It's good to hear you this morning, and hello to everyone joining us this morning.
Yes, and join us. By all means, we have some interesting comments already on the Twitter feed. Let's start with the Capitol horrible, deadly crash yesterday involving this woman who it looks like, I mean, they're piecing it together now, obviously had some serious issues. She was a dental hygienist from Connecticut who thought, apparently, the story goes, so far anyway, that President Obama was stalking her. She hit her car, tried to ram through a barricade at the White House, was eventually stopped in a big, deadly car crash, shot dead by the Capitol Police. She did injure a Secret Service agent. We hope he'll be all right. I don't believe she had weapons in the car. We're not sure. They, of course, are searching, I think, her home in Stamford. Her condominium complex was shut down last night to see if there was any weapons, bombs, notes, whatever they can find. But she had some troubles, it looks like. She had her 18-month daughter in the car, we should say, who thankfully seems to be okay. She suffered from, according to her family, postpartum depression. She also had, curiously, and you'll want to address all this in a moment, suffered a fall, I think, before her baby was born. And she had worked for a dentist who let her go. He was on the news yesterday saying she had started, after the fall, acting erratically, handling the patients in a rough manner, and they let her go. So there was a job loss to deal with, maybe some neurological issues, I'm thinking head injury going on, as well as some mental health issues. What is your take on this so far? And, of course, we only know what we know so far.
Well, I'm reading this case actually really very differently, but I have to be very honest. I was up to the latest until last night, 2 o'clock. That when I started following it, my first thought would come: she didn't have a long-standing history of mental illness. And why do I say that? Press always comes up with an immediate picture frame where they want to put everyone in. It's guns and mental health issues. It is kind
right.
of like,
yep.
we are safe, nothing happens, no normal person would ever do something like that. These are the mm-hmm. gun nuts, and they are all crazy. And I'm using that word very loosely because we all have cheese tripping off, you know, our head. Somehow we have all our issues. Well, initially my thought was she is 34, she has an 18-month-old, she is a single mom, and kind of she ran her own business, and I knew that she was a dental hygienist. So I thought, well, there's a stress factor. Let's just, you know, look at that story. We're all living in a country here in America, we're very stressed out. You have your own company, you have to run that, you need insurance. Recently we had actually the changes with the Affordable Care Act. Truth is that there are changes to your insurance. If you are alone living, you have a baby, you need insurance. I just opened my plan in September. I was promised I wouldn't have to change it, but I knew that's a lie. I have to change it, and I will have to pay higher premiums. But apart from that, so there's also life stressors that you can see your friends and many Americans going through. So where is our breaking point? That was my first thing just looking at the case, okay? Someone reached her breaking point, and she drove towards most appropriately Washington, right? The capital.
Right.
That's
yeah.
kind of who people
yeah.
blame. My second hypothesis was immediately, I said, well, I want to know how old the little girl is. first of all, I'm so sorry for that little one. She lost her mom, you know. We talk about her maybe later. But the fact is, I thought, too, maybe postpartum. Because, you know, she seemed to live alone. The man, obviously, was not in her life. And I treat a lot of single women or women in relationships, and it's sometimes really overwhelming. People who are highly functioning, you never know if you might have a postpartum and it's not addressed. And people can not only be depressed and anxious, but they can have psychotic features coming with that, right? It's not always like with Andrea Yates, where someone has a long-standing history. This is a long-standing history of psychotic issues and schizophrenia. With Andrea Yates, the Texas case, the lady that killed her children many years back, that is mental illness. So now, blending back to this young lady, the comments that the dentist actually made, and I want to say, I learned while working with the media, I can appreciate it, but some of the major media outlets, as I said before, they try to create their frame before even any news is there, and they try to fit every case in there, and that is really very offensive and annoying to me. The dentist yesterday said that, yes, she was falling down. She had a head injury. But, Amy, I was treating many people with head injuries while I was working in jail. I nearly said while I was in jail, while I was working in jail. You know what? A second home. The fact is, there must be remarked differences, right, for the functioning before and after. And generally, family members know it best. I had young ladies, they had severe accidents or head injuries, and before they were very mild-tempered, you know, they were very conscientious, they did their job. What happened after the head injury, totally different personality, very explosive, okay, very kind of trouble-seeking all the time, no longer reliable, and the family was in despair. So you can assess that, correct? There's a marked difference from baseline. So if Miriam would have been your sister, and they spoke to a sister yesterday, one of her sisters is a former, I think, New York police officer, too.
Yeah, New York City sergeant, retired, I guess.
Yeah,
exactly.
And they spoke to one of her sisters, and she said she didn't notice anything wrong with her. She just spoke to her a couple of days ago. She didn't display any different features. So the family would have reported that. So it's not that a head injury and that stuff and then change in personality and behavior goes by unnoticed. Also, be real. When you're getting hospitalized and you're in a good hospital, they will keep you there and do neurological testing and see your level of functioning. The dentist boss also actually reported in the articles that I pulled, and I always pull a variety of articles because you cannot just, you know, listen to the most trusted sources in news on both sides, okay? The dentist said actually that she displayed no marked change before or after. She found out that she was pregnant while she was in the hospital for the fall. She seemed happy. But he said she had kind of a little bit an anger issue, a violent temper. And he said that was persistent. And it became even more difficult after the injury. They just told her not to park in the handicapped parking space, which she shouldn't do anyways. And kind of she was more explosive. So the fact is that seems to be a long-standing pattern. Just because someone is angry and or violent at times, in a sense, in their reaction, not that she harmed anyone, that is not, you know, by per se a mental illness. A good friend of her told us that she sometimes appeared to have a chip on her shoulder, and that was sometimes why people had a harder time to relate to her. But I think we have to really distinguish one from the other. People always make up stories. Also for the Navy Yard shooter, and people are on screen talking big, and I say, honey, you shouldn't talk about things that you have never even learned about, and that is really disturbing to me.
Well, that's why we have you. But so what do you? So I'm a little confused because obviously there was something going on with her. Are you saying she was just stressed out to the max, and this is what happened? Because that is very scary to me.
I don't know if she was just stressed out because I have not, and I want to be honest, read about voices or this delusions that she might have had. If that would have really gone on, I mean, her neighbors even said she's very mild-tempered. They felt she was friendly or mild-tempered. They never had an issue. But look, the woman had bought a condo. I think it was approximately $250,000. I heard that. There were issues for a couple of years back or a year back with the association. Then they settled it internally. She has an 18-month-old. She is a lone working mother with her business. It means, yes, we forget that in America, I love this country. I am American. We are stressing ourselves out more than any other nation that I ever lived in, even compared to Singapore. And Singaporeans work like crazy. I think here we have much more pressures. And pressure, you know what, becomes generally the number one workplace murder or stress. It's the number one workplace murder factor, and people always overlook that. We are like hamsters sometimes in that little wheel, and then at one point people can't do it anymore. So we have not verified, or I have not verified that, oh my God, she would have had these delusions that actually the president was stalking her or the psychotic idea. But you know what we know for sure? She wrote it on Facebook that she felt all men were wreckos. And you know what? That's a very common problem for women who are single or even single moms in their 30s because they feel they can't find a reliable guy who wants to stick around and doesn't live in Candyland, meaning unwrapping everything that he meets or every woman who he meets and then wants to move on. So there might also be some issues there. You know what I mean? So I think I always want to stick with the simple facts until bigger issues are actually found out. Because when I started with this business years back, I believed some of the reporting. And then after, it means my chin dropped and I say, oh, my God, these guys make that, you know, stuff up at times as they go.
Uh-huh. Well, you know what's interesting, and we're talking about it, so I always say we're very quick to judge and to talk about things, but we're in the middle of it and we're doing it too. So I agree with you. We need to be cautious. Sometimes it's better even with some of these ongoing trial cases. I think in England, you're not allowed to really have the media exposure until after the case is solved. And it might be better to do it that way because you do guess a lot as you're going and you're right. People like to frame, I mean, the show is about stories in all forms, true, fiction, et cetera. And we like to frame everything in a narrative. So you're right. The media wants to put something into it. It's troubling no matter what the story is. But as you said, we don't know if it was underlying mental illness or just this combustible mental illness of life, of contemporary life that just sort of came to a head. If you remember that movie Falling Down years ago with Michael Douglas, where he was at workplace also, and he just sort of lost it. So, yeah, that's a scary proposition. That's all scary. And when you go back to what we were going to originally start with, the Navy Yard shooter, another workplace or just mass shooters, and this woman didn't have a gun, so, of course, guns is not part of the equation. A deadly weapon, a car can be a deadly weapon, too, as we know. That's scary because a lot of us are driving. Yeah, exactly. And if you add cars, and sometimes you have cars and guns with road rage, that's another whole story. But the Navy Yard shooter is a little bit different because there were a lot of red flags, yes? I mean, we've looked at this for the last few weeks, so you tell us your take on that, but there were some red flags that he kind of, people either overlooked it or did not treat him enough, I guess. I mean, I don't want to blame anybody. But.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I want to cite kind of, you know, Ronald Reagan here. There is, before I cite him, I tell you something, and everyone has to listen to that. They don't have to believe me. But people out there is no control for outliers. That means I don't have a helicopter or anybody who works in mental health flying across the roofs who should be made out of glass then to identify who might have some cheese tripping at that point, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And remember, we have all issues. So the fact is Ronald Reagan said something. We must reject the idea that every time a law is broken, society is guilty rather than the lawbreaker. It is time to restore the American precept that each individual is accountable for his or her actions. Now, listen, I covered the Navy Yard shooting. I think I had five, six gigs that week. We did it all over radio and locally. And again, I was very cautious. The fact is that CNN or any other station came up quickly with, again, oh, yeah, a gun-owning mental health monster who was never treated. But the fact is, if you go back, this guy, the young gentleman, had actually explosive a tendency and temper and a history of violence, dating back to that he shot through his apartment roof at one point, and people said, oh, Ma, that could have happened. But the fact is the woman who lived above said she felt threatened by him before he confronted her in the parking space that she would have made too much noise. later on or before that, he shot into a construction site and into the car of a construction worker. I think that was in Seattle, because he felt they made too much noise. This is not necessarily indicative of mental health. These are people that I have seen in jail who went later to prison, who couldn't get their stuff together and had violent tendencies. I agree that later on, before he was arrested, he would have called the police, which is highly unusual, in my opinion, for someone who hears voices to tell the police. But that's, again, just neither here nor there my stance. He would have called the police and told them, well, I'm hearing voices, or I'm kind of like I'm controlled by this, you know, how can I say that, by this electromagnetic waves. And at that point, and we have not seen that report, and again, it was said, some reliable sources would have said that. Until I see that report from the police office, I don't even really believe it. That's just how cautious I have gotten. Because the fact is, if you're called in and someone reports that to you, then generally you pick him up and bring him in for a 72-hour hold to a psychiatric unit in order to see what's going on with them. That's probably...
And they did not do that.
An involuntary hospitalization. But I have not seen the police report either, because before, again, two of the major like players reported, the family said he had mental health issues. It came out later on, no, maybe father would have said that he was close to 9/11 and would have helped later on there. That was the initial story. But even I know people who survived 9/11 and who worked as helpers there. That doesn't make you someone who goes out later on and plans a shooting. So even if this guy would have had mental health issues, Amy, and I'm not denying that he had maybe psychotic, you know, episodes at that point, that doesn't mean that violence and evil cannot coexist with it. You still have a planning capacity. He had a clear time to prepare for it. He did it. He went to separate states to try and attempted to acquire weapons. Okay? And then last but not least, his discharge from the Navy, he barely made an honorable discharge. I think he nearly actually really met all the qualifications for an dishonorable one. But the fact is, there is no prior mental health record shown. Even later on, they say, he would have gone to the VA. Where are the records? I think half of these things are made up sometimes by the media, and they never are actually asked, show me the hard facts, honey, before you speak. And that makes me very upset, because many of my patients deal with serious mental illness, bipolar, they're on medication, they're functioning, they're doing their best. And they're always portrayed as monsters, sometimes by people where we don't have records, like Adam Lanza, another major outlet here. This was the Sandy Hook shooter, said, he had clear mental health issues in America, all these guns. Honey, there's no record, and we have to be really, really careful.
Well, I don't know about that. No, I would disagree on that Adam Lanza, because there was, he was removed from school. I think there was some records of certainly difficulties in school. Whether he was diagnosed with something, I don't know about that, but I think there are some clear issues. But I do want to underscore what you just said, because it's so important about your patients and other people, because when things like this happen, you're right, you become, everybody who suffers from mental illness, experiences mental illness, is lumped into that category, and that's so not true, because most people who grapple with mental illness, and as you said, everybody has issues of all kinds, are not violent, and people are more likely, if you are suffering from a severe mental illness, more likely to be a victim of a crime than to actually perpetrate one. So I think we have to underscore that. And also, when you do that, you sort of then hinder people from seeking help. You know, it's another thing where the stigma is there if you have sought help. Also, if something comes out that somebody sought help, it's like a stigma. People should be able to seek help. And I think the statistics will bear out that most people who are mentally ill are not violent. So that's an important
point. Let me add something. It might be of interest to all of us. The major thing that impressed me with the Navy Yard shooter was the statement of his mother. I loved her statement. It was very objective. She came forward, and she just said, I don't know why he did that. And the fact is, she did not say anything about mental illness, et cetera. And most relatives, if that's the case, come forward. I also understand the cultural component that was played before. African-American community, we don't address this, this, and this. But this guy was not, he was very worldly. He traveled to Thailand. He tried out Buddhism, okay? So the fact is, you cannot say this is always like that. And I'm jaded because I'm living in Chicago, and I covered Jesse Jackson Jr. And again, mental illness or the claim of it was used, right, in order to get easier off the hook with some charges. So I'm always wary about it. I'm not saying that in this case, the Navy Yard shooter, there was nothing. Certainly the last couple of weeks, there was something going on. But again, it's this easy solution. Oh, we don't have just guns. Guns don't shoot people. People shoot people, number one. And then number two, it is not always mental illness, as people proclaim. It is also the stress level. It's the isolation that people face, because it seems even the Navy Yard shooter, was he connected? We never heard anything about a girlfriend or a long-time relationship. We don't have any family support systems anymore. And people are sometimes out there and really isolated. And when they're desperate for many things, and I'm not saying that he was that, but, you know, there are terrible measures going on, and we have to look out for each other, I feel.
Yes, I do. But at what point do you call it mental illness? So this is what I'm saying in terms of maybe not a specific diagnosis, but all of those factors, if it bubbles over, clearly in the moment that you're committing that act, there is something wrong. I mean, because a normally functioning person would not do that.
Well, I think there's a problem with that. That's what good people are seldom suspicious, and it's hard for them to realize that normal people wouldn't do certain things. And maybe I'm a little hardened. Listen, once in my first couple of months in jail, someone came upstairs. He was sent there. He wanted to be transferred from general populations to the mentally ill ward, right? People always think you have special privileges. It's easier to make it there. And so he came in, and he looked very, like, together. He was well-groomed, and he said, well, he's just here for a marijuana charge, and he feels a little depressed, et cetera. And something inside of me just turned. My stomach twisted. I was still a young intern back then, you know, many vintages back. And I just said to myself, no, he doesn't meet criteria for anything. I'll send him back to general populations. He's not suicidal, homicidal. Then I checked the database, you know, later on, and I talked to my supervisor, and she said, yep, you just met the guy who was here because he has actually raped his 8-month-old daughter, and she died from the consequences. He wasn't mentally ill. He was just not crazy. He was just violent. You know what I mean? And in America, I think we have this, at this point, we have the thing, we rather say, oh, the person is mentally ill. We have people who are psychopathic. You just have to read Robert Hare, very important, you know, a researcher on psychopathy. We have people who have no conscience. I'm not saying that was the case in the Navy Yard shooting, okay? But it's hard for us to believe we want to protect ourselves. That would never happen. People need to be sick. We refuse to say some people are evil. And this is kind of then spilling over into mental health. For us, when someone comes into my clinic, right, to see me, or even when they have a clinical consult, some people going through adjustment issues, a lot of stress, right? You're going through a divorce. At that point, you're a little anxious and depressed. I call it, that's not yet mental illness for me. It's a stress reaction, and that's what many people go through. When I talk about serious mental illness, it's a long-standing history, for example, of bipolar, mood swings, extreme mood swings, you're on medication, right? When you have severe psychotic features, when you have schizophrenia, et cetera, you know, or long-standing depression, when it impairs your life. And most of the people, like, for example, going back to Miriam Carey, they lived a fairly normal life before. That's what we see from the outside. And because there's not many people that we call collateral information or collateral people, like family members or partners, who could actually tell us, no, they had changed or not. That's why I'm very, very, very weary to immediately jump to the conclusion, oh, these people are majorly ill. We have to know that certain things we will not be able to prevent.
Exactly. Well, yeah, that's true. We can't prevent things. Hey, if you want to get into the mix here, it's 347-857-4505. We're talking with Dr. Daniela Schreier, a number of justice topics on your mind as we go to the Twitter feed. A couple of folks, speaking of stressful divorces, want to know your take on the Zimmerman divorce follies. George Zimmerman seems to, well, we haven't heard from him this week, maybe because there's so much news out of Washington, but he and his wife, or his strange wife, Shelley, are in the news. They seem to want to be in the news. And now, of course, it is the divorce and the big public display of something going on, maybe domestic violence, maybe a threat, maybe just a crashing of an iPad. We're not sure exactly what happened, but then Shelley went on the Today Show. So it's back and forth. It seems to be this need to be in the public spotlight. He's an interesting case because, of course, he came to the fore in that very sensationalized trial. The shooting of Trayvon Martin, he was acquitted. It was a controversial verdict. Then he went out and got himself, first he was like a Cape Crusader, helped a family in a car crash, and then he was stopped for speeding a few times, and he made a public appearance at a gun factory, and then he had this thing with his wife. Where are you with him? Do you think he's looking to be punished, or do you think he just loves the spotlight? What is your take on George Zimmerman at this point, and Shelley also?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think, you know, our media, certain media outlets, and that's not an offense, it's big business. And, you know, you portray or you write stories about what you think people might love to read. Many people of the American public, and I hear that, see that, are obsessed with crime time. What's going on? And the fact is, for Zimmerman, he had to stay in court. I have my very own thoughts and opinions about that. As a matter of fact, he has been acquitted. I do think that, for example, he has shown definitely a poor judgment, right, when he was caught speeding or when he still had guns in his car, and he might say, well, he has the right to bear arms. That's true. It's America. But certainly doesn't – and maybe he was even scared. He needs to be able to defend himself. The appearance at the gun factory –
but he also has a bodyguard. He also carries – he has a bodyguard and he carries a gun. I mean, one or the other, you don't need both.
Well, you know what? It means probably he feels that his life is in danger and there were threats to both families and to him too. So he can decide what he wants to do. Unfortunately, we cannot make decisions for others. I see that. We can only control ourselves. I hear your point, however. You know, they are in the media. They are out there in the spotlight because I think they, or his wife, they got the whiff once that, hey, that's quite interesting. Why don't we make that maybe work for us? But remember, she was in court shortly after his case, and she had a forgery, a case, you know, and I think she was...
Perjury. Perjury.
Yes, thanks, thanks for correcting me, Amy. Thanks for keeping me honest.
Okay.
No, but you know what? I'm dealing with a lot of divorces, and that's a very, very stressful period for people when we also step aside from the Zimmerman case, right? Because very often one person is already out of the door, as a matter of fact, with both feet, and the other person just opens his or her eyes to the fact, oh, my God, this guy wants to leave me, or guy or woman, or for both. And this is very painful, and going through that, very often, once it's getting ugly and one person wants out and the other person doesn't want to let them go, often the police gets called. I had people coming to jail all the time for domestic violence accusations. Generally, you are called. You have to take in one person. It's generally the guy more than the woman, even if there's not much evidence of anything. So I'm not surprised that she called the police. She also, it means, okay, he had maybe a history of a violent outburst, et cetera. It's up to her to call them. But it would not be out of order that that happens throughout certain divorce proceedings that have gone bad, and people become very jealous. People don't want to let go. For him, certainly, that was devastating, right? Because, again, you come into the news for very bad events. But it didn't surprise me. Even in couples who generally or sometimes get along well, they're drinking, they come home, they fight. Sometimes 911 is called. It's a stress reaction. It's very difficult. And people talk about losing their primary relationships, their homes, their houses, dividing up the 401ks or retirement funds. And it's getting ugly. You know, that's the majority of people that I see in my practice very often. It's a life-changing event. What do you do?
Well, if you look at Shelley, I mean, of course, she's a lot of people call her the woman scorned. But if you look at her, she stood by him during the trial. And apparently there were some difficulties before the trial. But she stood by him every day. And then when her trial came up, by the way, the perjury charge was for lying on her behalf. On his behalf. And he was nowhere to be seen. He was out in his quote-unquote victory tour. So, yes, I think there was some resentment on her part where she felt that, you know, this guy didn't stand by me. He's out the door. He left me behind. So maybe she exaggerated it. And who knows. But I think her rationale on the Today Show with why she reneged and she took back her story when the police came was because the police told her everybody's going to go get arrested and you're going to stay in jail because she had the conviction. So I think she was afraid of that. So it's a scary situation. I think we have a phone call. Let's see. It's always fun to see who's on the other end. Hey there, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, do you have a question for Dr. Daniela?
No, I'm sorry.
All right, hang on. That may be our next guest. I'm sorry. We'll be with you in a moment. We have David Patton coming up, by the way. He is the author of a moving memoir called Dummy. He'll be coming up in a couple of minutes. See, we talked to you, Dr. Daniela, and we just have to keep going because it's so exciting. tell us. We lose ourselves. There's so many stories and compelling issues. Somebody asked, what's the latest on Jodi Arias? I thought she had a hearing today, but I haven't heard, so maybe they pushed it back. Again, her case, she's convicted. We should always mention convicted murderer. They have to retry the penalty phase. A lot of, she's kind of fading from the media now, and I think maybe the family would be wise. Again, you can't speak for them, and they don't make the ultimate decision. It's up to the prosecutors, but I think they have some influence. Maybe making a life behind bars deal wouldn't be so bad because she's not in the media so much, and she's going to have to just – that's what's going to be the ultimate fate anyway, as whether she gets life or death. She'll be in a box for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. I know we've talked about this a lot, but do you have any quick comments on that?
Well, I think that the case is a little bit on ice right now, and you can be sure as soon as anything comes out, HLN or other stations will report on that because it was very much a sensationalized trial. I think also Jodi Arias was not very likable or appeared not very likable to most of the viewers, and some fell in love with her, I think a minority. And you know what? Whenever we are close to someone, even in real life, and that's maybe important for the viewers to know, we don't see their faults. We don't even see very often if they're lying or when they're lying because we don't want to. That's just our qualities as humans. But I think it was a fascinating trial, or still is, because, Juan Martinez, he was so passionate, and some felt he was such a bully, but he made it really, it means if they ever would make, a film about that, or like the new Columbo, right, they should have him actually act. He's great. I love him.
They did make a film about it, but I agree with you. I think he was fiery and great, and if you need somebody to be an advocate for you, that's you. Now, on the Twitter feed, I did get a couple of comments. We don't have a lot of time left, but let's just get to it quickly, and we'll have to have you come back as this unfolds also, about Amanda Knox. I mentioned we were going to do Amanda Knox, and a couple of people said, well, why are you lumping her in the same category with these people who were convicted? And I'm not. I'm just talking about it. She was convicted, then it was overturned. We're talking about the young woman who was convicted first and then overturned of killing her roommate along with her boyfriend and another man in Italy. She spent 4 years in prison in Italy. They overturned the conviction. She was freed. She's now back at home in Seattle area. And now Italy is retrying her, which is something that wouldn't happen in this country with double jeopardy. It is happening. I'm not sure why. Some people say there's new evidence. Other people say it's still very flimsy. You know a lot about it because you've lived in Italy. You followed the case, and you know the differences between the systems. We don't have a heck of a lot of time, but what is your take on where we're at with that now?
Well, I followed the case from the very beginning. Yes, my family lives in Florence, and so I spent many years in Italy. The system is very different. In America, it would be like double jeopardy, but that doesn't exist in Italy because they feel it's still the same case, and it has just been reopened. Okay? Also, I have followed it from the beginning, and Perugia is a very, very small place in Italy. There is a university for strangers, per gli stranieri, as we call them, and there are two very different subcultures. I think there's about 164,000 inhabitants. It's very traditional as a place, but then there's the college campus and maybe all the foreigners coming in, and they are more regarded as the sex party and rock and roll, division of the city. So most of people in Perugia actually would say that she and her boyfriend, interesting enough, people say, well, he's Italian. But you know what? Raffaello Sollecito is not from Perugia. He's from the south. He's from Bari. And there's an inherent bias in Italy very often for people coming from the south. So we have watched a trial that we found maybe that there was character defamation going on and she was like treated badly, all that with the police. But people in Italy, in that small city, they would say, well, why do foreigners come over here for pizza and sausage? And I'm not talking for the sausage on the pizza, okay? Especially when we talk about women. That's the truth. It means there's kind of an inherent bias sometimes. And so... it's an interesting case still, and I'm glad for her. She shouldn't go back to Italy because they have the right to reopen the trial. The first judge has been implicated himself. That was actually Mignini, that he had a long-standing history of bullying. He also had a framework, like many media stations here. He thought that's like a demonic sex crime, and he viewed everything from there. But now we're just hoping that the new guy, Nencini, out of Florence, looks at it a little different.
Now, were you talking about the first judge or the first prosecutor? Because the judges, I think it's a panel of judges, I believe, right, in Italy. It's a fascinating case.
The first, the former judge, the prosecutor, Giuliano Mignini. I apologize. I say English third language, but that would be a bad excuse. Yeah, it's the prosecutor, Giuliano Mignini.
English is my one and only language, and I make mistakes too, so don't worry about that. But, I just want to make sure, clarify, because I think they have a panel of judges there in Italy. But it's an interesting case from our perspective, because even in this country, it's kind of polarized on people thinking whether she's innocent or guilty. It's funny, because people like Jodi Arias, with the rare exception of a very small percentage of people, mostly men who would be her next victim, but that's another story, or Casey Anthony, most people believe they were guilty. In this case, or Scott Peterson, most people believed he was guilty. In this, with Zimmerman and Amanda Knox, it's a little more split. There's more polarization of some people thinking innocence, guilty, that she did have some bizarre behavior with the cartwheel and the kiss. Who knows? I mean, again, with the reaction, I always say knock on wood. I mean, I don't know how you'd react and how everybody reacts. My point is, if you really are a true psychopath, a sociopath, rather, you mimic what people are, what you should do, so you would probably act really restricted at all times and do the right thing. And, you know, if you're swept up in the moment and she was 19, 20, whatever it was when it happened, I mean, it's just a... it's an interesting case. We'll see how it unfolds. We'll have to have you come back because I have to wrap up now. Always a pleasure, Dr. Daniela. We need to see you more often. I know you're busy. And by the way, people can find you at drdaniela.com, and you tweet with people in real time, which I know a lot of people will appreciate, at Dr. Daniela. So thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Have a lovely weekend. Bye-bye to everybody. Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye. We'll talk to you again, Dr. Daniela. Always a pleasure.
Yep.
That dial. We'll be right back after these brief words from our sponsors.
Chock full of nuts is that heavenly coffee, heavenly coffee, heavenly coffee. Chock full of nuts is that heavenly coffee. Better coffee a millionaire money can't buy.
Than dirt. Stronger than dirt. New Ajax laundry detergent is stronger than dirt. Stronger than dirt. New Ajax laundry detergent is stronger than dirt.
Back, it is the Amy Beth Berkley Show. Give us a call, 347-857-4505, or go at the Twitter feed, AB Writes, and we'll take your comments and questions. We want to welcome to the show David Patton. He's the author of the moving memoir, Dummy. It discusses his life, which started out with lots of travails, challenges as a young boy growing up in Chicago, in the Chicago area in the 50s and 60s. Diagnosed on the autism spectrum, had a lot of academic, social, and psychological challenges, but he has become a successful businessman, and despite being functionally illiterate, managed to write this very moving memoir. David, thank you so much for your patience, for hanging on the line, and for joining us today.
Thank you.
So this book is very fascinating. We'll talk a little bit about how you came to write it in a moment. It's a compelling story that I think can help a lot of people because a lot of people face challenges, and certainly you faced your share. It's interesting to note that you grew up in an educated family. Your mother was, in fact, a psychologist, but little was known, really, about the autism spectrum back then in the 50s and 60s. And I think a lot of the blame was actually put on your mom, who, by all accounts, tried her best to be a good advocate and a compassionate person. Tell me about some of your early life and your struggles.
Yeah, my mother, or mothers at the time of autistic kids were referred to as refrigerator mothers, and my mother was not, I don't think could be described as a refrigerator mother, whatever that is.
You mean they were cold to their kids? They weren't...
exactly right, yeah. And that they didn't make a connection, and the kids never learned to make a connection. That isn't the case anymore. We're much more aware of what autism is and the causes of it, although there's still a lot to learn. But I struggled with learning disabilities and autism spectrum, dyslexia. So I was just had difficulties getting through school, getting through the subjects that that came to me through classes and stuff like that, and through home of memorizing kind of issues and stuff like that. I'm having trouble trying to describe my whole childhood in 5 minutes, I guess. But it had a lot of the common learning disability struggles, but then also I knew I was going to have to try and make it out in the world because I was being mainstreamed into public schools and stuff, and so there was a lot of coming to terms with my disabilities in various ways.
Yeah, and you had some, unfortunately,
caused myself and other people a lot of trouble. Go ahead.
But you had some teachers also who weren't that sympathetic in some cases, too, because they weren't as aware of what was going on, too. And in one case, I think your second-grade teacher, you describe her, you kind of wonder, regardless of what people knew about the autism spectrum at that time, she might not have been in the right profession. That's just the way you describe her.
Yeah. It's funny because other students described her as being very nice, and I think she really, really did love the kids and try to help them. But mostly... with the kids that were doing well, didn't know how to deal with the people that were falling behind. And I think back then people just thought people were smart, not so smart, stupid, or lazy.
That's what you say, yeah. And then she figured the way to get the lazy out of you was to hit you or ostracize you. And somehow I don't think that's a loving, enlightened teacher. But, whether it's 60 or 90.
It's not effective either.
And not effective, exactly. But, you open up your book. The first chapter, I think, is very moving because it's you open it up in 2005 when you're about to be fired from a job. And we should say you went on through all your travails, and we'll talk a little bit about it later, but you went on to become a very successful professional in the telecom industry. And you were working for a company at a time when they were changing some of their technologies. And your position, as we said, you were functional literate, so you had to use a special program. You made compensations. They also hired you knowing that you had these issues, and they worked with you, and you still had all these stellar, I'm not sure how many years you worked for that company, but you had stellar evaluations, and they call you in. It was you wrote it so well, and it was so heart-wrenching, actually, because here it is, 2005, you're an adult now. They call you in to not fire you, because I guess because of the Disabilities Act, they couldn't do that or whatever, but to sort of ambush you and get you to quit, which you ultimately did, but in such a way that it was so cruel, with a room full of people, the person who was ultimately in charge was on speakerphone from a remote location, your immediate supervisor who may have had a hand in getting you in trouble or whatever, was there. A couple of people also who worked in the company were there, and they were tearing up with this. It just seemed like they confronted you in such a way that it was so cruel. And I'm saying this is an adult person. This is a professional person, a person who's respected in this company, and you're treating him so poorly. I mean, there are good ways and bad ways of letting people go or demoting them or whatever. I mean, why call somebody in and give them a bad evaluation in front of other people? That must have been a horrible – and you write it very compellingly, and it's very moving, but it's a horrible – must have been a terrible experience to go through.
Yeah, and – in my life, my career had been a difficult process in developing. So I was also watching a lot of what I had done to build this career starting to break up and fall apart. And part of it, you know, it sort of culminated in this moment. But I think that people had decided, it's easy to decide, I think, when somebody has difficulties with reading or something, that they're just not that bright. And it's difficult, I think, for some people to look any deeper than that or the surface level to make judgments. And I think that's part of the problem my immediate boss had. And once he took a certain approach to who I was and what I was, it's not that hard to get other people to follow in being critical of people.
Yes.
And I think there's a
momentum. How long had you worked there? Because you had been doing a good job. That's what's interesting.
The job I was doing was in charge of the landlines for this wireless phone company, and their call center. So it involved very critical issues. If the call center went down, there'd be a few hundred people that couldn't get their job done that day. And I had been very successful at that. They moved the call center and they made some changes, so there was a change in the job description, and that's how they got around the learning disabilities. They denied me any use of – I have – there's programs that help with computers to read documents to me, that kind of thing, because I have trouble with reading. So I had these devices that would help me, and I don't think anybody that maybe wasn't told ever knew that I had – people I worked with knew that I had difficulties. I don't think it showed, and I got my work done, and very well. In fact, I was in previous job too, working for the manufacturer of this equipment, Northern Telecom, PBXs. I was a main character in the repair of these, and traveled all over the United States in emergency services and crisis management of projects and that kind of thing. So I had 27 years of experience in this industry and was well respected, throughout the United States in it.
To be reduced to that feeling of like, and I think you said in the book, you reverted back to what it was like when you were a little kid, of feeling this shame.
Yeah.
And this just a horrible way to deal with anybody. It's really hard to imagine that, come on. This is not how you deal with professionals. It's not how you deal with adults.
I still run into a few of those folks, and they won't even look at me. I think they're a little ashamed.
Well, they should be. It was an awful. Yeah. But it's a horrible way to do it. I mean, I know in radio I've seen people, they're always firing people in radio, so it's pretty common. But sometimes you have these old guys, usually guys who have been at the radio station for a long time, hosting the morning show or the news guy or something, and they want to ease them out. And I've seen it done in a graceful way where they give them sort of like a farewell tour because, of course, there's an audience also that loves them. And then I've seen it done where they just tell them that they come in and, you don't work here anymore. I mean, so there are different ways of handling it. And
I think their stance had more to do with the legal aspects. They wanted to make sure they were doing it all legally correct because of the laws for disability. I'd hired on as a handicap with disabilities, so and specifically about reading and writing. So the compensations they were willing to make were allowing me to put a program on the local computers and in the office so that I could have them read to me. And in this session, they told me, no, you can't use any specialized equipment, you can't do any of that or have anything on our company computers to help you. And it was obvious they were giving me a new job description, which changed the job, which obviated the law or went around the law. And so they were more, it seemed to me, more interested in how they were trying to manage the law than really who or what I was.
Yeah, they wanted to get rid of you, but what I'm saying is if that was the case, and I'm not saying it was right by any means,
yeah.
but still, if that yeah. was what they wanted to do, there are definitely better ways they could have done it.
They
didn't have to bring you in and shame you in front of all these people. And to me, that was just heartbreaking, and the way you wrote it. I mean, and kudos to you for writing it that way, but I mean, because it definitely moved me. I was like, this is a horrible thing to happen to this man and
yeah,
to anybody. I mean, that's
yeah,
just not the way to do it.
Oh, yeah, no, that's much better ways. I agree completely. And it was
but
a
you
shame.
Were...
Go ahead.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say your life. You had a lot of ups and downs in your story, and in the book you do talk about your relationships and your family. You really were so despondent at some point that you tried to commit suicide. You wound up in a mental hospital for a while. I mean, it really there were so many aspects to your story, and the fact that you triumphed after all of these things, and you found spiritual life, you found relationships. You're married, you have kids. I mean, how did that all, you know, where did you find the strength to continue and to make those transitions into obviously a better life and now a fulfilling one?
Yeah, well, I went through a lot of various ways of trying to deal with it and come to terms with it. And I don't know that there was some ultimate perfection in that at all or could be, but it did help a lot for me. To a big part of the process of really about accepting who and what I am.
Mm.
And I couldn't really do that until I'd been confronted with the absolute necessity to have to do that. And I avoided it much of my life. But also, I think others around me couldn't accept it. And it's very important for people to stay clear on what people's strengths and weaknesses are in special situations, I think, for both parties as much as possible.
How did people not make it so personal?
Pardon me?
I was going to say, how did people in your family or your friends, your people you knew, not manifest their not accepting the way that you were? They just tried to deny it? Is that because it seemed like your mother was kind of had a handle on it early on. She knew there was something wrong. I mean, she tried to, you know, she struggled with it. How did it manifest itself with other people?
Well, in each situation, it was different, particularly with my mother. My son ended up with some learning disabilities, and I feel like I dealt with it very differently. I think it would have been better to focus on what I was capable of doing rather than what I couldn't do. What I couldn't do was read and write very well, a number of other things, very bad short-term memory for names, numbers, that kind of thing. But I think that if they'd accepted, oh, yeah, you've got these liabilities, maybe you won't learn to read earlier, then I wouldn't have been forced to focus so much, almost constantly, on what I wasn't learning, rather than learning a momentum that there is to learning that I didn't discover till much later in life.
Right. In other words, the things that you could do, and then you obviously excelled at. So, you know, if you had done that earlier.
Yeah, and I managed to find some of those things. I had my family. My parents were very, very supportive in many ways, and really probably the best situation I could have had, which was very helpful. I had some other situations that weren't as helpful, but I think that when a person has some liabilities and the life or the circumstances around them are struggling to accept it, it just makes it that much more difficult for the individual to come to terms with it.
Yeah. So it's been an arduous journey, but you've done it, and I think you put this book together, which I think will give hope to a lot of other people who are struggling, not necessarily with the exact same thing, because there is no such thing as the exact same thing. And now, of course, as you said, they do know so much more about the autism spectrum. It's a wide spectrum of things that people deal with and cope with, and they're better at it. There's still some ways to go, of course. There's always learning about it. But I think you do, there is light at the end of that tunnel, and hopefully people can reach it sooner than you did and not have to struggle, because it's so much pain that you had as a young person in your life that, you know, you wish obviously now you're a parent, you know, you don't want your son, you handled your sons because you were more aware of situations. You handled it differently. You don't want your kids to go through that. Nobody does. And that's why I think that first scene was so moving and sad, because here you are after you've made all those transitions and triumphs, and you're being reduced back to this by people who really should, people should know better to have to how to handle people. So I congratulate you on the book. What was the process like for writing it? Tell us about that as you're, you know, with your,
well,
your struggles.
I was just coming out of being, you know, let go at the company. So I was reassessing kind of my whole life. I was in the process of trying to, I'd noticed that somehow I kept returning to these moments, you know, and found it very difficult. I took it all very personally. I thought my liabilities were who I was and what I had to deal with and what the world represented to me in terms of my strengths and weaknesses seemed insurmountable on some level, you know, as a kid and then for moments in this moment as an adult. And for writing the book, I just sat down and started in Word typing, and I couldn't spell the words correctly. I had trouble with these speech-to-text programs because it's a little hard to explain, but they would make mistakes, or the program would make mistakes interpreting what I said, but it would sound very similar. I mean, the words that would come onto the page when they were read out loud sounded very similar to what I was trying to say, but when my editor would read them, it was completely wrong, so it was hard to catch mistakes that the programs would make. And the editor had trouble interpreting what I was actually trying to say. So I ended up having to use Word. I typed in what I would try to say and misspell much of it and not find the words. I would just put in X's or something where I had to try and find a word or something. But through that process and working with him and a number of other great editors, managed to sort of put it together through conversations and stuff like that, and it took about 7 years to write it this way. Every word was a struggle to get on the page, but it made everything very considered. I think it's well written, and I think everything, I don't know that there's a word in it that wasn't necessary for the story that I was trying to tell. So
what an achievement, really. Congratulations.
Yeah, great reviews on it. I appreciate that.
It's a big achievement. It sure is. I mean, it's an achievement for anybody, but especially knowing your struggles. And I'm sure you are going to impact other people and give them some hope, and I think that's great. Where can people find the book? Do you have a website, by the way?
Yeah, I do, at dummyamemoir.com. You can purchase the book through that or through any of the distributors, Amazon. You know, it's
Barnes & Noble. Ask for it at your local bookstore if you have one. David,
yeah,
it's really a pleasure.
They may
meeting.
Have to order it. It's not necessarily in all the bookstores, but yeah,
sure,
that's right.
But you can order it. David, yeah. Always really a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for joining us. Congratulations on the book. And what are you doing now? Do you have anything, any plans, or you just
I'm working on a fictional book that's that I'm very excited about. And
oh, really?
Oh, yeah, I think I've decided to become a writer, even though I can't write, so it's very strange. But,
this is a novel. It's hard enough for those of us who can, so
yeah. Well, I have to get those that can to help me with a great part of it. But in terms of getting the thoughts on the page and getting the consideration on the page the way I want it, you know, there's something I enjoy about that, and I just think it's very strange to try and find what, you know, for everybody, difficult so oftentimes to just find what it is you want to do with your life. And I'm not sure I would have ever come up or realized that writing might be something I could do or find my voice. I think that's something that can help anybody. But to find my voice took losing my job somehow. So.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that's a fairly common thing, but not so common for someone who has writing struggles to then go on and become a writer. So that is a daunting task, but I applaud you for it, and maybe because it's so precious to you. You know, for those of us that have a more natural inclination for it, we take certain things for granted, and people who have to work really hard at it and sit there and even work harder than – it's hard anyway for anybody, but especially with having some kind of disability.
Yeah, I think it's really important, I think, for those that – haven't felt they've had a voice or found their voice, I think it can be really quite a moment when they find a voice. For particularly people that in our society that haven't historically had much voice, the fact that I think more and more people are starting to come out with a voice that didn't have the capacities to express it before, and this is one of them.
Exactly. It's liberating, for sure, and empowering, and I wish you the best with it. It's dummyamemoir.com. David Patton is the author. A very triumphant, moving story. I recommend it, and I thank you for joining us, David. I hope you come back and see us again.
Oh, thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Stick around. There was an engineer. Choo-choo Charlie was his name, we hear. He had an engine and he sure had fun. He used good and plenty candy to make his train run.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Don't know any other candy that I love so well.
Negotiating is a bore.
Ladies and gentlemen, with sequestration taking effect and yet more deadlines approaching, we have gathered some of the top-ranking Democrats and Republicans in the Congress. Please welcome Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan. Senator Mitch McConnell. And the chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Barbara Mikulski.
We have looked for common ground, and each person says SF.
And it looks like we have thrown the country off a fiscal cliff.
If we can't get it together with this economic mess,
we just might miss our next recess.
Sure, we can't come to any kind of agreement on this economic disaster, but what would you do? Since it seems that each and every one of us up here has the brains and the maturity of a honey boo-boo.
So we need someone to blame somewhere in the world.
Don't you pin the blame on me. I've done nothing.
Yes, I agree.
Why'd we pass this legislation? Why did we force our own hand?
Since we could not meet our deadlines, there were cuts throughout the land.
And the middle class has lost its tech rate, just like we all feared.
Thank goodness we hung up this year.
I don't see any way around this problem. It's an enormous fiscal hurdle. But it makes sense that things always progress slowly when you consider Mitch McConnell looks exactly like a turtle.
So we'll pass legislation today to take at least one problem away, to make sure they cannot sequester our pay.
The Capitol steps their unique take on things in Washington, not the easy business to leadership. Yeah, they're not the place for congressional pay, much to a lot of folks' chagrin, but a lot of everybody else, federal workers, like we mentioned, the Capitol Police, they're still working, but their pay is being held hostage. I know they'll get back pay, but some of these people need to get paid week to week. They need their living paycheck to paycheck. It is outrageous what's happening. They're still negotiating. Supposedly they're going to do some mini votes tomorrow on what they call mini funding measures. This is the Republicans' way to try to stick it to President Obama by saying, well, we're willing to fund certain things that they think might be important. And I guess they're getting heat from their constituents. But it is just crazy gridlock. We'll see what happens if they can resolve it over the weekend or not. People will be impacted in a big way. And you know what? A lot of these bloviators in the mass media are coming out and kind of saying, yeah, it's no big deal. I don't feel it. You know, it doesn't affect me. I'm not going to a national park or a museum. What's the big deal? Yeah, Okay, first of all, again, we talked about the people that are impacted by federal funding in terms of their jobs and programs they need, like veterans benefits. Social Security is still going out, so that's okay. Military pay, they did pass that one measure, thank goodness, to allow the military to get paid. That's good. But it's funny how they didn't have a measure to let Congress not get paid, which is really what they should do. Congress, by the way, if you look at a recent poll, outrageously dipping down 10% and going down to single digits in approval rating. President Obama, to be fair, also going down, but he's still in the 40s, so it's much higher than Congress. But they took a poll. I don't know who took this poll, and I can't believe some of these things. But apparently, things that poll better than Congress include Brussels sprouts. Okay, some people like them. Root canals. Nobody likes those, right? Colonoscopies. Not usually on the top hit list. And head lice. I can't believe head lice actually surpasses Congress. So that's how popular Congress has become through all of this. We'll see what happens. I don't know, but I hope you're not impacted, and I hope it is resolved soon, because we're all going to be impacted at some point. I mean, food inspections are going to stop. So I know there's one crazy bloviator who probably has a whole bunker full of his freeze-dried food that he advertises, so he'll be all right. But if you like seafood, the inspections are stopping, so be careful on that front. A lot of things will start impacting people, and certainly if the stock market starts reacting, it's kind of been not reacting that strongly yet, you're going to see your 401Ks, your IRAs, your stocks go down, and that will affect everybody. So it's not a good thing that we're in the midst of, but we'll see what happens, and let's hope for saner heads to prevail come, by Monday. Let's hope it's resolved as quickly as possible. Hey, by the way, if you have a something you'd like to talk about, you want a story to tell us, please head over to the website. It's amybetharkowee.com, also creativity coaching questions, and find out about the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series. We are celebrating both Killing Time, the first one, which takes place in October. We're in October. We've got great Halloween shows coming up, too. And, of course, the latest release, Dead Silent. Find out more about that, as well as workshops and upcoming signings and readings, all at the website. Follow the show, the Amy Beth Arkwee Show, at the Blog Talk Radio site. And you can follow me on Twitter at AB Writes. Aurora doing a great job. That's her new spot at the Twitter feed. And we thank, of course, Trudy for producing the show, and ML at TCS headquarters keeping us on track. Dr. Daniela, always a fan fave. Come back soon. We appreciate your insights and analysis on all those justice topics and beyond. And David Patton, what an interesting man, put together a very moving memoir called Dummy. Check that out. I hope you have a great weekend. Whatever you do, wherever you go, please do drive safe, play nice, and dream big. Come back on Monday. Oh, by the way, Monday program, we've got some fascinating folks. Peter Hochstein is an author of a very amusing memoir, and he'll talk about his tabloid experiences as a tabloid reporter. And Marta Cunningham joins us. She's the director of the compelling new documentary, Valentine Road, about a very horrible shooting and murder at a middle school and a young person who was struggling with sexual gender identity issues. That's all coming up on Monday's show, the Free Flow Pop Culture Convo. We'll check in with the Inspiration to Action Challengers, too. Hope you're doing that. Keep me informed on how that's going as well at the website, amybetharkowee.com. Hey, whatever you do, wherever you go, drive safe, play nice, dream big. Come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkwee Show. Take care.
Into the crowded line, break down, take down, you're busted, shake down, break down, hurry, just about the time to think it's all right. Break down, take down, you're busted, shake down, break down.
what we've got here is failure to communicate.
A whole war with England over that.
aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less bark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart, and baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby. Baby, close your eyes and listen to the music. Dig to the summer breeze. It's a groovy night and I can show you how to use it. To come along with me and put your mind at ease. Less conversation, a little more action. All this aggravation ain't satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less bite, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart. And baby, satisfy me. Satisfy me, baby. Come on, baby, I'm tired of talking. Grab your coat and let's start walking. Come on, come on.
Come on, come on.
Come on, come on.
Come on, come on.